Welcome to the Education Podcast, the Learning Conversations with Gillian Hamilton. I'm Gillian and I'm Chief Executive here at Education Scotland. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Graham Armstrong, the author of the best-selling book, The Young Team. Graham, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Graham, I want to kick off because I've got so many questions I want to ask you today. I'm really privileged to be sitting opposite you. You're a best-selling author. I'm sure many of our listeners have read your book. You know from a previous conversation that I've listened to it as an audiobook, so you've walked around Glasgow accompanying me with your story. But for those who've not listened or read the book, can you tell them a wee bit about what your book's about?
The Young Team is basically the fictionalised version of my lived experience as a gang member in the 2000s in North Lanarkshire. So it was a particularly violent time. The 100 years of gang culture had culminated in peak violence, basically, in the city and in Scotland. Glasgow's murder capital of Europe, and young people like me who live in working class communities are pulled into gangs, and that was basically my life. You know, lost my father young, and that was a big catalyst for me being involved in our street life, using substances, alcohol, and very lucky. I found inspiration. You know, when I found a work of literature that changed my life, went to university. And then in the first months of recovery, when I was 21, I started to write. So the Young Team is my story.
So the writing was actually part of the recovery journey?
Absolutely, yeah.
And you talked there, Graham, about that was life in North Lanarkshire at that time. Looking back, is there anything that could have made it different for you? School, family, or was that pull to that culture that you talk about just too strong?
Years later, reflecting on it, I think the masculinity thing wasn't really understood, you know, back then, or spoken about in the same way, and especially for a young man that's lost his father, there's a sort of masculine deficit. So I was always, you know, didn't know footballers, I was always kind of behind the rest of the lads, so it turned into a sort of hyper-masculinity with me. You know, it was this need or this want to really promote yourself as a tough guy, basically. And that made me incredibly vulnerable as time went on. But yeah, there was absolutely no youth services at the time. There was no youth clubs, so literally adolescents were just on the streets. And that was the result, really.
And you mentioned, really interesting, you mentioned the word vulnerable.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that you didn't feel particularly vulnerable at that point. It's only looking back. Yeah. Tell me a wee bit more about that.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of paradox at work here. You know, the more young men predominantly act invulnerable, and that hard shell you encase yourself in, actually you become more vulnerable. You're more involved in violence, you're more at risk of self-harm, suicide, as we know. You know, the figures back that up totally. And our mental health was affected by trauma of the stuff you endured as a gang member, but also years of substance dependency and alcohol abuse.
And, you know, when you're See, I've told you I had lots of questions already, but you talked there about mental health. And again, as a young man at that point, you wouldn't have been aware of that. You wouldn't have been thinking, my mental health's affected here. This is a challenge for me. But looking back, all those largely young men that you were spending time with, they would have had the same sense as you, wouldn't they? I'm invulnerable. I'm fine. I don't need any support. I don't need any help.
It's the powerful allure of gang life, you know. It's full of bravado, it's full of glamour, but actually it's very short-lived, that stuff, you know. So I found myself in mental health crisis when I was 16, you know, having serious anxiety attacks, panic attacks, because of substance abuse, but also because of constant stress and, you know, a sense of hypervigilance, living with your head over your shoulder, looking for people, fear of violence, being exposed to, you know, being in the circumference of people being murdered. Is a lot for a child, and it's hard to think of yourself as a child in that environment because your childhood almost dies immediately, and you lose that innocence of youth, you know. And big focus in my work, that lost youth, it's something that I've kind of mourned. I had to kind of mourn my own youth as I became an adult.
That's interesting, because I remember when I was reading the book, you talk a lot about the elders and the role of the elders in that context. So actually those role models, looking up, there was almost a kind of rite of passage from an age band into another age band.
Totally. It was aspirational. You know, these guys were like anti-heroes, if you want to call that. You know, in a place where, you know, you weren't doing well at school, you were getting no admiration or recognition from any other spheres. you could be somebody in a gang, you know, their guy's names was painted on the wall. That was some, you know, on social media, which was at its advent at the time, you know. We talk about social media, it was a new problem, but it was always there, just in different forms. We didn't have a smartphone in our pocket, you know, we had a PC in our mum's living room.
You're showing your age now, Graham.
And you know, but that was at the advent of that. But a lot of the stuff, you know, it's got worse. But actually back then, it was still there, you know. I've got pictures in my work I do with staff and schools that of young men brandishing machetes, catching knives in their mum's bit. You know, it's putting this Spartan warrior a major to the world, but actually beneath it, you know, it was just an act. They were actors. They were acting tough, but, you know.
And one of the things for you, and I know you talk a lot about this and in the book too, I'm conscious it's based in experiences, but the role of education in the midst of all of that, the story about the role of your head teacher, or the role of the head teacher, was really, well, as a former head teacher, was really, really powerful for me. But through it all, I got a sense that education was a help, a saviour, etc. If you let it, can you talk to me a wee bit more about that role of education, the role education played for you, and how it took you down a different path?
Education in high school, secondary education, was a game of two halves for me. My first school was a big school, it was 1,200. Just the culture in the school was very much do not pass go. Exclusion was the first resort, you know. And I was excluded 4 times and then permanently excluded, so suspended and expelled by age 14. So not a positive experience, you know, albeit I had a few advocates. There's a, you know, a MacGyver and a Mr. Rawlinson in every school. Yeah. And I had good ones, but it wasn't enough because the culture of the school was pro-exclusion. So I found myself in front of the authority, age 14, looking for a new school, expelled, you know, take full responsibility. You know, it was an act of violence in school while under influence of alcohol. It was serious. But the lead up to that was, you know, it was silly stuff, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, those 4 exclusions that contributed to that were silly. And then when I go to my new school, you know, this is a nurtured environment. Before that was a buzzword that we used, you know, because Mr. Rawlinson, the then head, said, you know, you're a guy that dogs school all the time. I'm not sending you up the road. You can come here. You can work in my office. You know, so he actually had x-ray vision. They could see beneath the shells that young men put out and he could see the vulnerability. And he also acknowledged he might be our last chance, you know, before we hit criminal justice or before we have a premature death. So, and I know, you know, from insights that people shared, he got a hard time off staff. They didn't always feel the most supported because he was somebody that supported the bad boys. But actually, you know, he realised that the kids that were doing really well, they were going to do well anyway. But we were pivotal.
You talked there about advocates, and sometimes there's not enough advocates. What do schools need to do in that space? What do we need to do more of so that choosing a different path doesn't happen by chance?
You talk about trickle-down economics. I think it's trickle-down culture from school leaders. You know, and when I go into a school that the school leader's 100% involved and on board with this stuff, you actually see that resonance right through the staff, and then that filters right down to the pupils, you know. And then schools that are less involved, that have maybe got a more affluent catchment, that think this doesn't really apply to us, there's a very different kind of welcome that I get as a speaker. So, you know, vis-a-vis, you can tell that the kids that are involved, you know, while they might be few in number, are slipping through the net, you know. But it's honestly, I had this exceptionalist thing, and I thought Mr. Rawlinson was like a 1 in a million. He's not, he's actually 1 in every school, and I've met loads of them, you know. So I think, honestly, one of the most positive things I've seen is nurture hubs, you know. And all right, you know, sometimes people think it's a bit dangerous minds, you know, or a bit, you know, it's sort of paying lip service to it. But actually, it's giving pupils a space where they feel safe. Uh-huh. And sometimes that's the only place they feel safe. Mm-hmm. That's why they come to school. It's not always for education. It's for safety. It's for regularity. It's for that one trusted adult, you know. And there is lots of buzzwords in this, but they are actually true, and they do work.
And that place of safety is so important. You'll see in the media, I know that you'll follow education in the media as well. There's a lot in the media just now around behaviour, changes in behaviour post-COVID. There's the perennial challenge of attendance and the challenge of getting some young people back into school post-COVID, etc. What's your thoughts in those areas from what you're seeing in the times that you're spending in schools?
You know, I think the emphasis in the media, you know, it's like we're looking for a hard line. That's what the mainstream media does, you know. We're looking to demonise, we're looking for a quick fix, you know, harsh justice rather than smart justice, you know. But any time I've been in Nurture Hubs, it's not about, you know, a social club in the middle of school where people don't want to go to class. It's actually somewhere where they can self-regulate, you know, and when you see the stress behaviour in a classroom, that's a place where they can bring that down. And they're approachable. Otherwise, you see the stuff that you see on social media, kids kicking off in corridors, teachers getting abused, you know. So, I don't know. I think, honestly, working at their full potential, Nurture Hubs are super important. And schools at Seconda, I remember I started full-time to that, get the best return from it. I was in a school in Edinburgh yesterday, and they'd organised a sort of symposium. So it was actually the targeted groups from Nurture Hubs from four high schools came. So it was only maybe 30, 40 learners. You know, but they're the most high tariff kids, you know, and it was really positive, you know. So.
And without breaking confidences from that discussion from the group, what were the kind of key messages that those young folk were sharing with you?
Oh, they weren't participating in that way, you know, but they turned up, you know, that lots of them. The problem with the high tariff stuff is you turn up and they've not attended, you know, so you can be ready to speak to 12 and you'll maybe get four, you know, but they all came. You know, some of them actually said, they don't come to school, they've only come to hear you speak. So they've given me a golden opportunity to reach them. And, you know, I'm very aware that we plant a seed when you do an input. Uh-huh. It's the school that waters that seed, you know, and it will pop, potentially. But it needs to be sustained, you know.
And we were talking, before we turned the mics on, we were talking about busyness and how busy you are. You can't be in every school in Scotland that message.
And it shouldn't be personality-led. You know, that there's a problem with the cult of, you know, the charismatic. I really veer away from that, you know. And I've followed my own charismatics, you know, Karen McCluskey, John Carnockin, and they are leaders, you know, in that sense. But this needs to be across the board, you know. And PSE, Soc Ed, they called in Cobridge, was a missed opportunity while I was in high school. We were being showed videos in first year of the AIDS crisis. That's how old these videos were. Mm-hmm. They were like late 80s. And they were totally irrelevant to us, so we totally disengaged. And there's, you know, a period or two periods a week where we could have been engaged that we were completely missed. And we should have been getting really profound drugs education, violence stuff, anti-violence inputs, and we didn't get it. Mm-hmm. So.
And that feels like a missed opportunity now.
It was without a doubt.
And like you, I spend a lot of time in schools across Scotland. It's something I've committed to in this role, and like you. What I see, you know, conversations with head teachers are telling me there are challenges with some young people, with behaviour, with attendance. But what I see, like you, is school teams trying really, really hard to try innovative solutions to address some of that, looking at engagement as well as attendance strategies, etc. But there's a way to go.
You know, skills are being portrayed as a battleground at the minute, and you know, the demand for the inputs that I do, so sometimes hard hitting, you know, S3, S4 anti-violence inputs, there is a demand because they're worried. You know, teachers are not immune to social media and the news. They know what's going on, and the return, these things rise and fall. We had if you look at the figures, violence started to fall rapidly in 2005, and there was a lull until 2014. Now, why did that happen? I think it's cultural shift, you know. But then now we've got economic distress, we've got global conflict, we've got the exact same things we had at the beginning of the 2000s, you know, repeating. COVID as well. I think COVID's actually a bit of a convenient scapegoat for a lot of things. You know, actually, COVID stopped violence rising in Scotland because of lockdown. Mm-hmm. We've had a 1% decrease in violent incidents, non-sexual crimes of violence in Scotland last year. But that's only 300 less incidents, and most of them are going unreported, so... the mood of the time is that things are worsening. Mm-hmm. No.
And two points related to that. One is, if that's our context, schools can't do this alone.
No.
That the support networks, the wider interventions have to be beyond school. But sticking with school for a minute, I know that you spend a lot of time with young people. You spend a lot of time with teachers. Can you tell me a wee bit about that?
It's... Someone gave me a very Scottish piece of advice when I said I was going to do teacher stuff. They said, well, don't tell your granny how to suck eggs, son. You know, and they made me more nervous when they said that. There's always someone to, you know, bring you down. But I said, well, I'm not going to teach a professional and they know about their profession. That's not my business, not my place. But I'm going to give them maybe another tool for the tool belt. You know, I'm going to actually, it's an empathy test, you know. because they see the hard shell, and if they've not got the x-ray vision on, are they seen beneath, or are they just seeing the behaviours? So that's what I do. You know, I do it. It's, you know, my lived experience doesn't change, so it's a lived experience, but it's also combined with academia.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's combined with the figures, it's combined with the footage, it's combined with seeing pictures of weapons and seeing videos of assaults that are really upsetting to see, for myself included, but also a reconnection, because we need to re-engage with the reality.
Yeah.
We can't live on a fantasy that, you know, violence was solved in the 2000s because it was a good story for the press. It's not true. You know, violence is always there in every school. But some schools think it doesn't apply to them, mm-hmm. because of the catchment, you know, because they come in a more affluent area. So I rebrand it. I used to say I talk about Scottish gangs. I just talk about youth violence now, you know, because they're like, we don't have gangs in our school. And I'm, okay.
But one of the
playing with semantics.
The first time I heard you speak, you talked about, and it was a real challenge, it was the School Leader Scotland conference, yeah. when you were speaking to a whole room of secondary teachers, and you challenged that room and said, these young folk are in your schools, they're in your schools today. And I think that was a hard-hitting message in the room, and I know it landed really well with head teachers looking to do more, be more in that space. You talked about social media there as well.
Yeah.
And you talked about back in the day, we'll use lots of old sayings, granny's sucking eggs and back in the day, but back in the day, social media was just starting.
Yeah.
Social media is in a whole different place with our young people now. Are you seeing the impact of that on young people and in your conversations across Scotland?
Almost every school I go into is talking about Andrew Tate. You know, it's talking about the misogyny problem. That is new. That wasn't a thing. You know, when a working class community like ours, it was a matriarchal, you know, mums ran the show. You'd never badmouth your mum, you know, but now we're seeing young men disrespecting female teachers. And there's also a sexual element to that, which is completely foreign to us, you know. And why? Because there's powerful Svengalis on social media who are very, very wealthy, who are putting out outward signs of wealth and privilege. You know, they've got a Lamborghini, they've got a Rolex. That's very appealing to a young person who's in economic distress, you know, or who doesn't has low aspiration, you know, because it's hard to compete with a guy in a Lamborghini, actually. But the reality is, you know, he's got an arrest warrant. Yeah. He's been extradited back to the UK to face sexual crimes, you know, rape encoded. So that isn't a role model. We want our young men. But their messaging is toxic, it's insidious.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be the countermeasure, you know, always, with all this stuff. Same way, you know, other cultural influences like drill music, violence has been glamorised. We're not in the business of blaming, you know, violence on art, but it's contributing to a culture of violence, you know, and we need to acknowledge, if you look down south, there's not a day goes by, practically, where there's not a mention of a young person being stabbed and killed on English streets. You know, that's happened in Scotland as well, increasingly, and we don't want to return there.
No.
That's where we came from in Scotland.
And you were talking there about, you know, influencers and how we work together to address some of that. But I'm really conscious, taking you back about 10 minutes when you talked about some of the videos that you saw in PSE's social aid as a young man, and how those didn't land. So actually, the balance of knowing that that's the knowing that those are the messages, but making sure that in education that the that political literacy, etc., getting that right, so that young people don't look at that and think, "Yeah, I hear you, but that doesn't land. It's out of date."
And I'm very aware that I'm 32 when I'm standing in front of 15-year-olds. I made the mistake of asking what year they were born that day, and they told me 2009 in S3. So it's historical fiction, but actually I'm only 16, 17 years older than them, so, you know, and they still see me as a sort of young person. I'm just probably on the limit of that, to be fair.
You've not moved over.
No,
you've
probably not moved over that slightly line. On the limit, you know, but the troubling thing is that they recognise their own life, they recognise their own community, they recognise their language, they don't feel judged by someone who's speaking West Central Scots. You know, I'm not an outsider. I've got a unique privilege that actually I'm viewed as an insider and a peer, which then, you know, can be fully used to full potential.
Absolutely. And that's a privilege and an opportunity, but it's also a big responsibility.
Absolutely.
You know, sitting in that space and being able to influence really positively in the lives of those young men and young people more widely. You're talking, just linked to that, you talk in your documentary, the Street Gangs documentary, about the gang culture. You talked there about shifting the language you're using in that, that role of popular culture. What has changed for those young people now, comparing back to your time in the gangs? What's different?
We always talk about the drivers being the same. So poverty, lack of opportunity, you know, and trauma and ACEs and all that stuff. And that is 100%. It's beyond dispute. The cultural shift is so important. We need to look at how kids are dressing, what music they're listening to. Because actually the truth is, being a Ned just wasn't out of fashion. It was out of fashion, you know. And the violence that was attached to that culture and ingrained in the culture also went out of fashion. So when you look at that big dip, kids were like growing their hair. A young man asked me the other day, why do you cut your hair so short? And I went, because we weren't like fashionistas like you guys. We were like military sort of haircut. And that was very kind of reflective of your behaviour. You know, but honestly, we need to look at culture and what's creeping back in. Football hooliganism, casuals, right? That's got violence attached to it. Drill music, it's beyond dispute that it's violent, you know? So we need to look and ask ourselves, we're adults, we can discern fact for fiction, you know, fantasy for reality, but can a 15-year-old child?
Mm-hmm. You know? You say we, Graham. Who's we?
Adult, well, I'm putting myself in with you guys now because I'm an adult. You know, that's a harsh revelation, but it's the truth, you know, and I find myself I'm more closely allied with teachers and police and professionals now than, you know, the streets, but it's that bridge effect, you know.
And it's maybe, you know, this is a bold statement, but it's maybe we as Scottish society.
Totally.
It's not the role of a teacher or a policeman, or it's how collectively as society.
Silos don't serve any of us, you know, everyone points finger at teachers and say teachers need to do more. Teachers, they've never stepped foot in a school and seen what teachers actually do. They've never been in a nurture hub, you know, when they're trying to regulate a kid who's not getting looked after in the community, you know, and this is their only sanctuary, and they know at the end of the school day they're sending them back to a place of danger, you know, or they're involved in stuff, you know, criminal exploitation with gangs, with drugs, you know, and kids aren't making it out of that sometimes, and that's it's a heavy burden on teaching staff. So it is a partnership approach. I said that once, somebody said, what's the solution? I said, what's partnership? And they said, you're starting to sound like a politician. And I said, no, that just means my messaging's moderate. And I realised that I don't have all the answers. Uh-huh. Teachers don't have all the answers. Criminal justice don't have all the answers. But when you put us all together, we've got a fighting chance.
I couldn't agree with you more. And actually, you would expect me to say this, but I think teachers do an amazing job in often really challenging circumstances. And when I'm speaking to teachers and head teachers, sometimes there's a frustration that they're doing more. Still isn't enough, but you know, I said earlier, I see amazing work and innovative practice, but it has to be a collective piece. You talked earlier about there'd be no youth services. Do you think that's changing? You know, I know that we're in really challenging budget times in Scotland, but the role of youth services, the role of CLD in that wider educational experience for a young person.
I know there's still good work going on, but you know, you look at local authorities across the country, they're cutting local services out of necessity. But the reality is, those local services in a place like Airdrie, Coatbridge, or, you know, Shotts, it's all they've got. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to encourage a young person into a positive pathway, but that pathway doesn't exist, then, you know, don't be surprised when they're on the streets. You know, and don't be surprised then when violence and alcohol and substance abuse becomes the elixir, becomes the thing that takes them out of that place of boredom. You know, and honestly, I make a point of asking young people in Scotland, what's your hobbies? Don't know. Why not? Oh, we can't afford it. And I'm like, guys, like, you can't afford it, right? There's loads of stuff that's on access, that we can access. But it's a mindset change we need.
Yeah.
And we need to focus more on quality of life. Getting work, getting education, employment's fantastic. But life isn't just about work. You know, if you ever find yourself with a pound in your pocket, how are you going to spend it? We need to focus more on well-being and actually quality of life. And give people a carrot instead of a stick to beat them. People sometimes look a bit, why is he talking about mountaineering? Because it was a positive pathway for me after gangs when I was trying to replace a lifestyle and meet new people, you know.
And again, giving that kind of advice to young people and hearing it, I know you think you're almost too old to be giving that advice. I think there's mileage, Graham. I think you've got a good few years left to be able to be given that advice. But actually hearing that from you, I think is really, really important. Back to that role modelling and influencing piece. Can I bring you back to education and your own education? Because, you know, you made that conscious decision to, you talked earlier about secondary school being a time of two halves. That second half led you down a very different path from maybe where you thought the first path was taking you. Because you went on to study, to write, and you've now got a whole number of qualifications in the bag with more to follow, hopefully. What's your learning been in that space about engaging in writing and particularly with the academic landscape in Scotland, given the background story that you took there?
You know, it's been a bit of a journey from that young kid who was put in a sync class, you know, in higher English because I was destined to fail. You know, and the girl sitting next to me, it was total fate. It was sliding doors and she said, you should read Trainspotting. You'd like that. That was all she said. Something very minimal, you know. And it changed the course of my life forever because there I was, a young man who was hopeless, who felt worthless, who had a very low opinion of himself, whose friends were dying. I'd actually seen a boy take an overdose on heroin right in front of me and I'd saved his life. Very dark space for a 16-year-old, not a solid foundation. But there I've got this book that somebody bothered to write and it's written in a working class voice like me. It's Scottish. It involves drugs and violence. That's my life. Mm-hmm. So that spoke to me in such a powerful way. It was that resonance with my own reality that was transformative. So then I go from being this kid to saying, I'm going to go to university because now I'm a product to another environment. I'm not just on the streets. I'm around kids that are expected to go to uni, who are applying to UCAS. You know, so there I am, you know, a fish out of water, as we say. And I was inspired and it was inspiration that was the catapult. But I failed. You know, my first hire, I got an F. Mm-hmm. You know, and a teacher said to me, you know, you got what you deserved. You know, you're a waste of space. Too much reading in university for some, don't you? So it's quite ironic now that my book is taught around Scotland. Yeah. It's taught in fourth-year honours modules in Glasgow University and Strathclyde. And I'm currently a PGR, PhD, doctoral researcher. So it's been a turnaround.
It's definitely been a turnaround. Folk listening won't be able to see my face because we're not filming. But when you were saying there about you got what you deserved, you were destined to fail.
Tough, eh?
That's tough.
That became...
those powerful messages.
I know. But it became a challenge, you know. And I turned an F into an A. You know, and I got three hires. So I left school with four hires and went straight to university. Which, again, is a difficult experience for working class young men. Particularly, you know, who feel different, othered because of the way you speak, because there's not a kind of pathway for working class people in there. You know, and it was about endurance rather than enjoyment.
You know, at university?
Yeah, I was still living that life, you know. My friend would go on to commit a murder. In my third year, I was stabbed. You know, I was very much living a double life, but education was a bedrock to build on. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I found faith and you know, I got into recovery and I was drug free. I started to write. You know, I was a fourth year student writing and I wrote The Young Team almost in its entirety in those months. So it became a companion to me. It became a life saving. It was a life ring, you know.
And was that writing then almost cathartic at that time in your life?
I think at the beginning it was. It was a companion. You know, I was alone. I was on my own. I had to socially distance myself from my community, from my reality. You know, and that's a very lonely thing. You're going against the grain, swimming against the current of everybody doing one thing, you're away doing this other thing. And education is treated with suspicion across, you know, in loads of communities. Oh, you're one of the brainy ones, you think you're better than us, and you know. So it's difficult to take that step, and it's a leap of faith that, you know, I'm committing myself to a process and it might take me somewhere, you know. But then, you know, Kathleen Jamie was my tutor, Scotland's Macca. Janice Galloway was a writer in residence who went on to mentor me and recognised that. You know, two really powerful female characters that took me, you know, from being this lost kid into, you know, someone who's doing a master's degree and then and beyond. Getting my life.
That must have taken some resilience. I know maybe at the time, you know, you were in it, but that ability to distance yourself from some friends, some community, be part of a new life engaging in academic study, I can only imagine that was really tough. So
the value starts to, you know, value starts to be built. Mr. Rawlinson built value when he told me, you know, you can do this. And when I heard that, he went into a room full of my critics and slammed my results down and said, there's the boy you threw away. He's got to Stirling University. He studied English. That changed your life. Mm-hmm. That made me feel what I was worth something. And that worth, even in the hard times, even when I was failing, you know, I failed modules and I had to go and do night classes and I just didn't get up, you know, and that kind of resilience.
Yeah.
There's loads of employable and education skills we learn in a working class community. Pride, resilience, commitment, you know, it's not just about talent, it's about energy and personality And those things, you know, kids tell me I'm unemployable, I can't go to university. I say, well, you've just sat through your first academic lecture in my talk here for an hour. And I said, and by the way, I asked a very adult thing of you there to sit and listen. All right, you want to take notes, but we'll get there. You know, so don't think education's all for you. It wasn't for me. It's for everybody.
And that role modelling is so important. I'm going to take you back to Mr. Rawlinson. Have you had a conversation with him?
Loads of times.
You left school?
Loads of times. I heard he was retiring, actually. And I went and bought a retirement card. And I went up and chapped the door, and it was his last day ever in school. And he laughed when he seen me. He went, wow, what are you doing here? And I said, ah, wee birdie told me you're retiring. So I came up and he spent over an hour with me on his last day just chatting. And when we were walking out, he went, you were my last success, boy. He used to call me boy. So it was a special relationship, you know. And actually, another member of staff at my previous school had been having trouble with this young woman. She's just gone off the rails. And she had mentioned, she said she really wants to go to Stirling Uni. Would you like take her for a coffee and show her around? And turns out the parents of that young woman were family friends of Mr. Rawlinson. And the parents were talking to Mr. Rawlinson and said, oh, this great guy. You know, he showed her daughter around Stirling Uni. He gave her a tour. He went, ah, wouldn't it be Mr. Armstrong with it?
Oh,
and do you know what he said? And I never knew he'd know this. And she's in safe hands. So it's always been there. And there was a gap. There was a gap between that. And then the next time he heard about me was when I invited him to my book launch in Sucky Old Street. You know, he's 68 by then. I shook his hand and great moment.
I'm filling up, actually. I'm glad we're not being filmed. I've said a couple of times.
It was a great moment, you know.
He must be so proud.
And then I was interviewing him for the BBC and his old school, you know. So, and then 3 million people seen that interview, you know, and it's been held up as an example of best practice.
Because often you don't get the chance. A really quick similar story. When I took on the chief exec job at Scale, the teacher who told me that I could be a teacher and that I could make it to university by total coincidence was in the room when I was making a speech at the Scottish Learning Festival, and I got to thank her. And I'm still in touch with her. Lots of young people don't get to thank the teacher who makes the difference, who flicks that switch. So I guess you and I are both really lucky that we've been able to share that impact that a good teacher. Mine was Mrs. Young, just in case she's listening to the podcast today. It was Mrs. Young.
A staff member said to me recently, they went, you know, it's not Dead Poets Society out here. And I went, well, you know what? Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. Mm-hmm. Teachers have got a unique opportunity, you know, that it's actually quite rare. You actually really make a difference to somebody. Criminal justice doesn't get that experience in a lot of ways, you know. They deal with the back end. They deal with when everything else has failed. Same with health, you know, same with prisons. We're at the start of the journey, you know, and a street educator, I suppose, you know, in that way. But honestly, I've enjoyed probably the most. Somebody asked me recently, what's the favourite thing about your career? And I said, honestly, it's been working with you guys, sitting in front of you guys doing all this and developing myself, because first time you stand in front of 100 kids, Jesus, you better be ready. You better be ready, because they're tough. They're tough critics. You know,
you know how hard it was then for those teachers in North Lanarkshire way back in the day when you stand up to do that bit.
I know. But a few schools I've been in doing inputs. My ex-teachers have been there, you know, and they're like, wow, I taught you, you know. And I remember how bad you were, you know, and how you disengaged. So it's a turnaround. But I'm not like this. I don't want to be this cult of personality or a charismatic. This is something that all people can access. You know, it is. Education's for everybody. Nobody can take it off you.
And I think there was a national discussion about Scottish education a couple of years ago, and one of the findings of that was Scottish education gets it right for many young people, most young people, but not for every young person. And that's not okay. That's not okay. You don't think it's okay, and
no.
I don't think it's okay. We talked earlier about that busyness and that you're in lots of schools been sharing that message. And I get your point around it can't be about you and it's not one person. But actually, if you're flicking that switch for teachers, for head teachers and for young people, then actually it's maybe about others sharing the load with you and continuing the conversation.
It's about partnership.
Yeah.
You know, it's about lived experience, absolutely. It's about the academics. It's about police. It's actually just, you know, it's a community. You know, I said in the Scottish Parliament, we were talking about community, and I said, you know, it's that old adage, takes a village to raise a child. So what does it take to raise a village? That's what we need to ask ourselves as a community, because we live in our own houses, you know, we don't communicate, don't even know our neighbours sometimes. A sense of community and togetherness has been lost, and that's really a big lacking. Young people live digital childhoods now. You know, their resilience is low, right? Even physical fitness is not that sometimes is affected by that. Just, you don't see kids running around anymore. We were always climbing trees and, you know, we were like, it was like jungle warfare, you know. You know, we lived in a kind of semi-urban town, you know, so, but, no, I don't know, there's loads of things we need to re-engage with young people. I think we've disengaged for a long time, because we had it easy for 10 years. There was no big crises of young people, but I think we are approaching crises, you know.
And I guess then the challenge that I'm hearing you from you today is then, how do we get in the front foot? And if I was being negative, you know, is it too late to get in the front foot? But if it's not, how do we get ahead of some of this? And I was struck by, I have to read this one out, but on your Instagram on International Women's Day, you talked about big hitters earlier on, and one of them you mentioned was Karen McCluskey, but you quoted a quote from Karen that said, we must keep trying, all of us, for we are presented with the opportunity to make real change. To change the destiny of some of the most excluded in our country, to improve their outcomes and those of their children. That is within our grasp. That's powerful, Graham.
It's my call to arms. At the end of every staff talk, I read that. You know, and it's so important to recognise it, because they're, you know, Karen and McCluskey and John Carnockin are two people who not only changed lives, but they saved lives. And they went against the grain. They took a moral stand. They lead. They didn't follow. They decided to do something different. And the outcome of that was not popularity. You know, they weren't popular at the time until they were. You know, they were going against the grain until they weren't, until they became best practice. So we need people not to follow. We need people to lead. We need to step forward always. Mm-hmm. Because young people, you know, they're growing up in an incredibly difficult time to be young in loads of ways. You know, and every generation could say that. But I think we're particularly isolated now in these silos. You know, kids might have a £300 t-shirt or trainers, but, you know, who's sitting and talking to them? Mm-hmm. Who's spending time with them? Well, I think we can do. But that for me, it's a call to arms for me personally as well, because it's talking about what so many great men and women talk about is actually, it's the cycle.
Yeah.
You know, it's about children and families. You know.
And breaking the cycle sometimes. And I, you know, I think you said it's a call to arms for you. I think it's a call to arms for all of us. And back to that question I asked you earlier about who's the we, and I think a really strong message from this conversation is we're all the we.
Totally. Nobody's got all the answers. Yeah. Nobody needs to have all the answers, but we've all got talent, we've all got something to offer, you know. And I had to do that litmus test in life that we need to do sometimes and think, you know, am I just a fraud, you know? And I'm like, but no, like, you've lived a life, you know, and you've actually achieved. And, you know, when I do, the more I achieve, I'm just thinking, I'm glad I can tell the kids in school this. You know, one of my slides for the young people is in Vogue. So the most famous fashion magazine in the world, modelling for Prada. And I said, that's not meeting my full potential, by the way. Here it is, talking to every head teacher in Scotland, yeah. Talking to the Scottish Government on your behalf. You know, and see, when you say that to them, like, what do you mean on my behalf? I'm like, because that's what we do. When you work in the community, we're serving young people.
Absolutely.
An idea, service, is sometimes sadly lacking in public life. But service is a great thing.
Yeah. When I was speaking to those head teachers earlier that I mentioned, and I was saying that when you take on a headship role, that's about a need to do even more for young people. And that is about service. It's definitely about service. And I was also talking to them about, smiling there when you were talking about being in Vogue, we were talking about imposter syndrome. But my message to those head teachers was, if not you, who? And I think that's, again, another strong message for us this morning.
Sometimes we're waiting for a hero to ride in and save the day, and it's you. You know, we're talking about one trusted adult being the change between life and, literally, the difference between life and death for some children. It's you. It's not who, is it? It's you. You know, you know what to do. You know what talent you've got. You know what gifts you've been given that you can impart. Now, that's a different for everybody. I know what I've got. I can tell a powerful story. I can capture attention for an hour. That's my contribution. You know, I've created resources that can be used in schools. I've created a novel, short stories. That's my contribution, but it's not just enough. You know, I need to then go and apply that in the community.
Yeah.
So when I do the talks, it's like applied, you know.
And we could talk all day. I know we could talk all day, but I'm conscious of time, and probably just to round off, and you did touch on this. We've talked about circles and full circles. Actually, seeing your writing on a syllabus for Scotland's young people must feel a bit like coming full circle, to be able to have that influence and for young people to be reading in our language, in your language.
It was,
that must be powerful.
You know, it was such a privilege when schools started to tell me they were using Young Team as a unit text, for not only for advanced higher and higher trainers, but for NAT4, for kids that are actually get low literacy, who are actually, you know, just about to leave school. But then last, you know, a fortnight ago, and when I got an absolute bombardment of teacher friends and people that I've met saying, you're on the survey, Graham. This could be in every school in Scotland. It was that one of those moments, you know, I told my mum and she was like, "Ah, you've done all right, boy."
You can always rely on your mum to keep your feet.
Totally. Your feet in the ground. Absolutely. But I come from an exclusively female family as well, so they keep me on my toes, you know, and I'm not a celebrity in the house, that's for sure. But listen, you know, and I understand, you know, some schools have actually actively said, "Oh, Graham, you know, I don't know if this is for us." It's, you know, parents and attitudes in the community. And, you know, it's that litmus test again. I was asked to speak in one of the independent schools in Glasgow, and I went, "Why the hell are they asking me to come and speak?" Right, but then I realised, right, it's an empathy exercise. Right, we're dealing with people that are naturally going to high attain. So they're going to be, you know, in the legal profession, the medical profession. They're going to be dealing throughout their career with high tariff people. They need to understand them. They need to realise that it's not just a choice, a lot of this stuff. It's a cycle, you know, and it's a difficult one to break. So I honestly, the thought of kids studying the book is just absolutely amazing. And I 100% support that, as I have right through. You know, Drumchapel particularly, shout out, Clydebank, Prestwick, areas that are typically a bit forgotten in Glasgow's rain shadow, you know, out with, just like we were in North Lanarkshire, Dundee. So I've got an affinity with these places, you know, so they're seeing kids not only turning up to school to do it, but actively, proactively reading. Some of them are coming in saying, "I've finished the book."
And that doesn't surprise me. What can I, what are they telling, what are young people telling you about the book when
just
you speak to them?
Love it, big man. Respect. You know what they're like, they're a bit cagey sometimes, you know what I mean? But the fact that, you know, an S3 group that are absolutely wild, that are known wild, that will sit for an hour and listen. The teachers think I'm like a hypnotist or something. You know, but it is hypnotic because what they're seeing is their own life. And that's powerful, you know, and that's what I was telling you about yesterday up in Edinburgh with the kind of symposium with the other groups. I got feedback off the member of staff who's full-time in the Nurture Hub, and he went, one of my really, really high tariff young people came back to me after the session and he said, "I'm going to try unschool now." I felt emotional, you know what I mean? It's just like, you've done something, you've changed something, you know? And a couple of the young men after it were asking me, you know, I've got criminal convictions, and I went, "Well, you know what, you can't change your past. But these people are here for your future. Right? Forget what's done. We can't change it. I've just told you about my past. Look how different my future is." That's the message.
That's so powerful.
It's
powerful,
a simple message, but, you know, draw a line. You know, see if staff are trying to help you in school. Let them. Yeah. Let them. They want to help you. It's free help. Take it.
And I think in the back page of your new book, you should have some of that feedback directly from young people. You know, normally you get feedback from, I think you should have in the back page of your next one, "Loved it, big man."
It's the best feedback you can get. That is the best feedback you can get. Same with, you know, in adult prison estate, you know, in schools. Kid reading is powerful. The first book I read was Trainspotting, like really read, you know, properly read. The next book I read was Gatsby, you know. And then that was it. No, that got me an A in higher English. But it changed your life because it changed your perspective. Read what you love until you love to read.
Yeah,
you know?
I saw that recently. I shared that.
I just heard that and I thought it was brilliant. You know, it's just an icebreaker. Once you're in, you know, you've taught them a skill that actually they can read. The booksellers in Waterstones were telling me, "Graham, after you get published, we've seen, you know, characters we don't usually see in here shuffling in nervously." And do you know what? I thought that was really, there's something really poignant about that for me. These guys, you know, street guys, working class men in a bookshop feeling nervous because he'd never been there before. But I'm like, "Where's that young team?" That's
brilliant.
That's honestly, forget awards, forget lists, forget all that stuff. Young child says that to you, they've made a difference, they're reading, you know, an adult that's re-engaging.
Changing lives one at a time.
That is one at a time, I say all
changing
the time.
Lives don't one try at and, time.
The systems are resistant to change. You know, these big political gestures we do sometimes, just deal with who we've got sitting right in front of us. We've got an opportunity. one at a time, because their child, that one equals five, you know, they go on to be a stable parent, right? They go on not to die a premature death. That affects hundreds, if not thousands of people. I'm one of them. I'm just one of them. I was just a lucky kid that read a book. So when I say, you know, I've got an intimate knowledge of art changing lives or literacy changing lives, I mean, I'm living proof, you know.
But see, as one kid who read a book and started to write, don't underestimate the power of your own voice. Don't underestimate the change that you're making, not
you
can make.
You pass on. Yeah. It's a baton, you know, you pass it on really, and, you know, loads of kids are doing it now. So it's good. It's a good shift.
On that note, Graham, on that note, can I just say thank you so much? I've forgotten that we've been recording as we've been blethering, which I think is the sign of a great conversation. Can I just say thanks for joining me today?
Thanks for having me.
To folk who are listening, who tuned in. If you've enjoyed our podcast, hit the follow button for a notification when a new episode is published. And keep an eye out on our social media pages, including our New Education Scotland Instagram account and our LinkedIn for news on the latest episodes. Graham, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.